Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The worst of the worst. We now know what companies are the nation's worst polluters. The Council on Economic Priorities annual report is out. Those on the list should be ashamed, say the researchers. Also this time, William McLeish, his new book, The Day Before America.
We need to remember that we are not just who we are today. We are still the sons and daughters of foragers, and we carry that huge time of living on the land lightly somewhere in ourselves.
The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The Campaign for Cleaner Corporations is an annual effort mounted by the Council on Economic Priorities. The point of the campaign, say organizers, is to get the nation's largest and worst polluters to clean up their act, literally. To accomplish this, the Council annually publishes a list of the worst violators, on the theory that the negative publicity will be effective where federal and state laws apparently are not. The list this year includes some familiar and some not-so-familiar names. We'll have the results in a moment. Eric Steedman, coordinator of the study, says whether to place a company on the list depends on some specific criteria.
We compare toxic releases between companies and within the industry. We look at overall releases, releases normalized for size, that would mean releases over per $1,000 sales. We'd look at Occupational Safety and Health Act violations totals, as well as, again, Occupational Safety and Health Act violations normalized over $1,000 sales. We'd look at a company's spills records. We'd look at a company's air permit compliance records. And we'd be good from there. We'd also obviously follow the media, follow stories, and any companies who had been involved in any obviously large environmental disasters, such as Exxon with the Valdez, or even though it's a bit outdated now, it is the 10th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster, or Maxam's ongoing fight with environmentalists and now with Congress over the Headwaters Forest out in California. These are sort of things that would certainly warrant us considering a company for the list.
And generally speaking, the information that you would use beyond what you see in the media, the other types of information, the sales and the toxic release information and so forth, this information is widely available, or is this something that you come by through your own sources and inside work?
Well, certainly a lot of it comes from inside work. There's a lot of digging. There's a lot of developing, maintaining of contacts. There's a list of participants who, over the years, have helped us out, helped us both by forwarding information, sharing information, and helping us also get our research out to their members. As well, much of the sort of raw data, I refer to the TRI, Toxic Release Inventory, and the Occupational Safety and Health Act violations, air permit. These sort of things are available on federal database. It takes a fair bit of work, and there is certainly some lag time in receiving and interpreting the information, incorporating it into the reports for each industry, but we do certainly rely on that. We also try and maintain as cooperative a dialogue with the companies as possible. We forward draft copies of company reports to them for comment. We encourage companies to comment, and where we see fit, we certainly do try and take heed and incorporate any of their concerns into the report.
What were the industry categories that you chose this year?
We looked at the aerospace defense industry, automobile, chemical, electrical utility, electrical equipment, food, forest product, oil, and pharmaceutical industries. We considered companies from everyone.
Okay, now, here we go. Drum roll, please. The envelope. Who are the companies, what are the companies on the list this year?
This year? Okay, we have 8 companies on the list this year. Exxon is on. Exxon's on for the second time. We cite Exxon for numerous reasons. They have had a very long series of problems with their Baton Rouge refinery. They continue to have extraordinarily high emissions compared to their competitors in Yellowstone County near Billings, Montana. They, of course, are still living in the shadow of the Valdez incident. We also named International Paper. They're the world's largest forest products company. They're on for the second year in a row. The judges did cite International Paper for having made some progress, especially in the area of disclosure and cooperation, but they still felt that International Paper had numerous problems to address, especially in the area of their continuing use of chlorine and some of their occupational safety and health figures were also not to the judge's satisfaction. Maxam, who I should elaborate, are the parent company of both Kaiser Aluminum and Pacific Lumber, are on the list for the third year. They're the only company that's been on since the beginning. They are, I'd say, a company who the judges felt have a particularly flagrant disregard for the environment. And certainly the experience that of the Headwaters Forest out in California has shown that Maxam's interests certainly focus on profits, and their interest in environment or even developing a rapport or addressing, you know, basic environmental and environmentally responsible issues is minimal, if non-existent. Southern Company are on the list for the first time. They're a utility, operate down in the southeastern United States. I'd say that their use and continued use of high sulfur coal is certainly one of the major factors that put them on the list. Texaco are on the list for the second year. Texaco has maintained moderate contact with the CEP, though it chose not to participate officially in this year's campaign for cleaner corporations. One of the major factors for Exxon's continued listing is the legacy of the country, the company's operations in the Ecuadorian rainforest. As well, there are some serious safety concerns that were raised with some of the incidents at the company's refineries. Union Carbide are on the list this year, have come on the list this year. I could certainly say that the history of their unwillingness to deal with the long-term implications of the Bhopal disaster is a large part of the reason they've come on. They've also had, were cited for serious problems in the area of occupational health and safety, as well as having a disproportionately large number of spills. Westinghouse, they are a diversified electrical equipment products company. They've come on because their toxic release inventory numbers are quite high, 50% higher, in fact, than the industry average. And they're also cited for poor performance in the occupational health and safety area. And there are a number of concerns with some legal actions against Westinghouse having to do with its nuclear reactors and facilities that it had designed and built. Finally, Westvaco was listed. They're a major New York-based producer of paper and paperboard. They were cited for being among the worst of the 21 forest product companies we monitored as far as their toxic release as adjusted for size. They were also cited due to the judge's concern over their reluctance to provide details as to their forest timber harvesting practices.
Steedman says the council not only publishes a list of the most egregious violators, but more importantly, includes with the list a series of recommendations for remediation. A teacher flunking a student, but then making suggestions for what to do next time to bring up the grade. Steedman says the list this year is slightly different from last year's. Gone this year are Rockwell International, DuPont, Commonwealth Edison, General Electric, Louisiana Pacific, and Texas Utilities. These six corporations, Steedman says, took the list and its recommendations to heart and, in the intervening year, made convincing progress. Steedman cites especially Louisiana Pacific, a forest products corporation, for making the commitment to stop using chlorine in its papermaking operations. The refusal to do so is what put International Paper on this year's list, says Steedman. Eric Steedman is coordinator of the Campaign for Cleaner Corporations, an annual study activity of the Council on Economic Priorities, a nonprofit New York-based public interest research group best known for its consumer shopping guide, Shopping for a Better World. He says reaction from the companies named ranges from compliance to angry denial. This is Bruce Robertson. Cassette copies of The Environment Show are available by calling 1-800-747-7444. If you call, ask for The Environment Show, program number 256. That's 1-800-747-7444, The Environment Show, program number 256. At sunset on the day before America, diversity lay at every hand. So begins author William McLeish in his recent book, The Day Before America. McLeish has embarked on a literary and, of sorts, a spiritual journey to discover the point at which everything changed, the point at which the land as it had looked to the earliest migrants thousands of years ago suddenly and destructively changed. McLeish is in search of a native sense, a sense both of what the land must have looked like and what it must have inspired to those ancients who first fished the rivers and turned the soil. If we could renew this native sense, McLeish believes, we might have a chance of saving what little remains of that land.
A couple of hundred of separate cultures shortly before Columbus landed in the Bahamas had developed in this continent, what is now the United States, and they lived very differently. Some of them, for example, were whalers in the northwestern part of the country. The most exquisite canoes, 40 feet long, unbelievable techniques for catching whales. Nearshore marine cultures in Florida that lasted for a long period of time without agriculture. Then there were gardeners and agriculturalists of all kinds just before Columbus got here. And those represent the bloom, if you will, of 12,000 years of occupation. And during those 12,000 years, you got a considerable variation on the theme of intervention in nature. Let's face it, man, since man has been man, and by man I mean human, ever since we stopped getting grass stains on our knuckles, we have been intervenors. Very skillful, very clever, and this is one of the reasons why we succeeded so well.
Although there were maybe 3 million inhabitants living in the various regions on the continent at the time Columbus arrived in the Caribbean islands, some fishing communities, some hunter-gatherers, some agrarian, these populations had little impact on the landscape for two reasons. First, of course, 3 million people spread out across the continent leaves a lot of room in between neighbors. Secondly, there was a different attitude, a different outlook. There was this native sense, McLeish suggests, is missing today.
They had a sense of mutuality. They had a sense that there had been a time very early on when animals and men were speaking to each other and that they were related to each other. And something of this belief still existed. And in some instances, if you will see it in the ceremonies of the Iroquois, for example, and other groups of Native Americans, there is still an appeal to the mutuality of man and all other beings, and a respect for all other beings. When you go to hunt a deer, you talk to the deer master, the spirit that looks over the deer, and you communicate with the deer himself or herself. And the deer, if you're going to kill that deer, the deer presents itself to you as the hunter. And the idea that in losing its life, it is reborn. Now, this is pretty wonderful stuff in terms of limiting the effect that you would have on a given environment. It was not, there's a huge difference, as you well know, between faith and practice. And you look at the buffalo jumps out west and numbers of other places. Well, good Lord, they jumped horses off of cliffs by the hundreds of thousands in southern France over 10 or 12, 14,000 years ago. But generally speaking, the forager lives lightly on a land.
And yet there was a tremendous difference between... It's wonderful stuff, mm-hmm. this theology of the deer mm-hmm. and the hunter. But that's something very foreign, very different, very alien to a European coming. What was the turning point then at the day before America that then we never could go back again?
Well, the turning point, as so often in history, the turning point turns out not to exist. It's a phase. It's a shift. There could be no going back after the first colonies of Europeans or Euro-Americans, whatever you want to call them, became self-sufficient or relatively self-sufficient. By then, you would have had the import of the most remarkable numbers of beings from microbes to which many of the Europeans were at least to some degree or another immune, and which just wiped out huge amounts of Native Americans who had no such immune systems.
You talk about things like measles and
measles fever and the various fevers and typhus, that whole thing. In addition, on the larger scale, pigs, cows, horses, sheep, and then you have wheats and oats and barley and grasses of all kinds and honeybees and, all sorts of things were being brought in. Now that, plus the arrival of a culture which was imbued with about as much energy as you could see in across the gamut of human experience, energized by the idea of markets, energized by the emerging idea of man as the rational being, man apart from nature, but gifted with this huge intelligence and able to take advantage of nature, to be the master of nature. All of this together was sufficient to start the ball rolling. And then after that, and quite soon after that, surprising to me, comes industrialization. So within 100 years in some instances, or 150 years, practically no time at all, you begin to get industrialization adding to an already powerful economy of agriculture. And with the obvious result on resources.
Was this necessarily a bad thing that the Industrial Revolution happened and had this effect?
It's so hard to say bad or good. It just happened. This is the thing that, in all of what I am saying, I never mean to say, all those terrible Europeans, all those wonderful Native Americans. This is ridiculous. We are all humans, and we all share the short-sightedness and the cleverness and the ambition and the fear of all humans. This is a given and must be observed.
Our cultural human evolution has been inevitable. Our discovery of fire, our experiments with seeds, our making of stone tools, and then eventually bronze and iron, our making of pottery, our ability to cut and shape stones for castles and cathedrals, our fascination for mechanized gadgets, from drawbridges to clocks to steam engines and washing machines and rocket ships. All this has been an inevitable journey, McLeish is suggesting that to see more clearly the road ahead, we need to recall the road already traveled.
We need to remember that we are not just who we are today. We are still the sons and daughters of foragers, and we carry that huge time of living on the land lightly somewhere in ourselves. That may be a measure that will help us in our salvation if we are to be saved.
My guest is William McLeish in his new book, The Day Before America. One of the ideas that occurs again and again is this notion of the sort of reciprocal relationship that humans have on the landscape, that we begin with the assumption that humans have been the force acting on the landscape. Mm-hmm. But a notion that comes again through your writing is that there is this reciprocal relationship where, yes, we do exact certain changes on the landscape, but then once those changes have occurred, they then, in turn, reform the way we live on the land, and it goes on in sort of an endless cycle.
This is true. It is what some ecologists have called the Red Queen effect, the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland, who says, here we have to run faster and faster and faster just to stay in the same place. And what the ecologists have turned that into is an idea that says that every being, everything on Earth, everything in existence really responds to each other, and any sentient being responds to others. And this goes from fleas to elephants. There's a constant adjusting to what other beings are doing, and we're part of that scheme. And we make changes. In the last 250 years, we have made the most unbelievable changes. There is, just as an aside, there is an argument that says that the Native Americans who lived here, as well as most foragers throughout history, lived in an ecological evolution. And with the taking fire of the Euro-American culture here, it turned into ecological revolution. And what the changes in the land that had taken place, over 2,500 years in Europe, took only 250 in New England. I mean, that you could see the speed. So that when you get this kind of a rapid shift, then you have to react to the shift. And this is what we've been doing, and we're now doing it at a speed which I can't keep up with. It's just unbelievable. If you see the changes in technologies, and the technologies are invented to a certain degree in response to the existence that we have molded for ourselves, and we now seem to be reacting to ourselves.
It certainly will never be possible again to live in such open space with such abundant resources as did the original settlers 10,000 years ago. Those who study the tea leaves say in the next century we could find a nation here with 400 million inhabitants, up from current 260 million. Though we may never return, we live in the same land that was here before the last ice age, and earlier even. McLeish believes that in the midst of our steel cities and concrete fields, during our rush hour lifestyles anymore, if we looked beyond ourselves and our time, even for a moment, there we would find our native sense. William McLeish, his new book is titled The Day Before America, Changing the Nature of a Continent. It is published by Houghton Mifflin. This is Bruce Robertson.
Native sense, it seems to me, is carried in this dream, this message from the center reminding us of who we are before we are anything else. It is wisdom not easily reached in the cultures of programmed cleverness, but we can reach it if we can bring ourselves to see existence as the web it truly is. Americans already have shown wisdom in creating national parks, in passing legislation to offset some of the worst effects of our meddling. Constancy is not one of humanity's most prominent traits, and sour economies and fears of dwindling standards of living have often turned us from our purpose and will continue to do so from time to time. But we can revive our awareness of our native sense if we talk about it to each other, if we listen to our lives in the old ways.
That's our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. Our thanks this week to production assistant Linda Anderson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE.